In 1866, ships across the globe reported encounters with a massive phosphorescent object moving at incredible speeds through the oceans. This mysterious entity shot water columns 150 feet skyward, traveled 700 leagues in mere days, and measured over 350 feet long, dwarfing any known whale. Public fascination reached fever pitch, inspiring songs, caricatures, and fierce scientific debates. The controversy seemed settled until the Moravian struck what appeared to be an uncharted rock, followed by the Scotia suffering a perfectly triangular hole below its waterline. Professor Pierre Aronnax, returning from a scientific expedition in Nebraska, found himself drawn into this maritime mystery. After exhaustive research, he concluded only two possibilities remained: either a colossal narwhal with extraordinary strength, or an impossibly advanced submarine vessel. When the United States government commissioned the frigate Abraham Lincoln to hunt this sea unicorn, Aronnax accepted their invitation to join the expedition, bringing along his devoted servant Conseil and meeting the legendary Canadian harpooner Ned Land, whose skepticism about the creature's existence would soon be challenged in ways none could imagine. After months of searching, the Abraham Lincoln finally encountered the mysterious phenomenon near midnight. A deafening whistle and burning light accompanied by sounds like a massive steam engine. By dawn, they spotted it, 250 feet long with perfect proportions. Despite maximum engine pressure, they couldn't outpace the creature, which effortlessly maintained 19.3 miles per hour. When Ned Land attempted to harpoon it, the light suddenly extinguished, waterspouts broke over the bridge, and men were thrown overboard, including Aronnax. Sinking into the depths, Aronnax felt something hard strike him. Clinging to it, he surfaced to find Ned Land, who made a shocking discovery. The monster was actually a submarine boat made of sheet iron. Before they could process this revelation, 8 masked men emerged and forcibly pulled them inside the vessel, beginning an extraordinary adventure. Their captors took them to an iron-walled cabin. 2 men entered, one short and muscular, the other tall with penetrating eyes. Despite attempts in various languages, the visitors showed no comprehension before leaving. Later, a steward brought clothes and served an elegant meal with dishes bearing the letter N and the motto Mobilis in Mobile, moving within the moving element. After a night in their increasingly airless prison, the submarine surfaced to renew oxygen. When the steward appeared, Ned attacked him but was stopped by a voice speaking perfect French, the commander himself, who introduced himself simply as Captain Nemo, meaning no one in Latin. Nemo explained his complete self-sufficiency. The sea provided all his needs from food to electricity. The sea is everything, he declared. It covers 7/10 of the terrestrial globe. At 30 feet below its level, human reign ceases. There, I am free. When showing his magnificent library of 12,000 volumes, he called them his only ties to Earth, adding that he was as dead as those friends sleeping 6 feet under Earth, hinting at trauma in his mysterious past. The Nautilus was an engineering marvel, a 232-foot elongated cylinder with double steel hulls joined by T-shaped irons. It conquered tremendous depths through precise buoyancy control, while electricity extracted from seawater powered everything from propulsion to air purification. Their underwater excursions required specialized diving equipment, India rubber suits with copper chest bands and lead-soled boots. 30 feet below, the ocean revealed itself as a dense yet remarkably transparent atmosphere where sunlight easily penetrated. They explored magnificent underwater landscapes filled with colorful zoophytes, rocks, plants, shells, and polyps, all transformed by light's prismatic effect through water. Captain Nemo's underwater forest featured plants growing strictly upward, never bending horizontally due to water density. Their journey revealed diverse marine life, armored ostriches, electrical fish with vibrant colors, egg-shaped ovoids, spiky diadons that inflate like porcupines, hippocampi, pegasi with wing-like fins, and clestodons that shoot water to capture prey. In the Gulf of Mannar, Captain Nemo showed Aronnax a massive clam with a pearl worth over 500,000 francs. Rather than taking it, he simply let the shell close again to allow it to grow larger. While observing this wonder, a lone Indian pearl diver was attacked by a shark. Nemo rushed to fight the predator with his dagger and, when momentarily pinned down, was saved by Ned Land's precise harpoon throw. After reviving the diver, Nemo gifted him a bag of pearls, later telling Aronnax passionately, "That Indian is an inhabitant of an oppressed country, and I am, still, and shall be, to my last breath, one of them." Nemo later revealed discovering a natural Arabian tunnel beneath the Suez Isthmus connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean, found 55 yards underwater after noticing identical fish species in both seas. Their journey also took them to Atlantis and the wreck of the Marseillaise, whose sailors chose to sink rather than surrender during the revolution. As they sailed the Mediterranean, Nemo's behavior grew erratic. One evening, he exchanged signals with a mysterious diver, then dispatched gold ingots worth nearly 200,000 francs via the pinnace. "The Avenger," Aronnax realized, glimpsing Nemo's mysterious past. The most disturbing incident occurred when they encountered a warship. As Ned attempted to signal it, Captain Nemo knocked him down, face contorted with rage. "Fool, do you wish to be pierced by the Nautilus's spur before it strikes that vessel?" Turning toward the ship, he unfurled a black flag. "I will show you mine." Despite Aronnax's protests, Nemo positioned the Nautilus to strike the warship's waterline. The steel spur pierced through effortlessly. Men crowded the ratlings, clung to masts, and struggled underwater, a human antheap overtaken by the sea. After an explosion, the vessel vanished into the abyss. Afterward, Captain Nemo retreated to his room. Following him, Aronnax glimpsed a portrait of a young woman and two small children. As Nemo gazed upon them, he fell to his knees, overcome with sobs. After witnessing the terrible destruction, Aronnax felt insurmountable horror toward Captain Nemo. The Nautilus remained mostly submerged, with Nemo absent for days. One morning, Ned Land whispered, "We are going to fly," having spotted land 20 miles east. As they prepared to escape, Aronnax overheard Nemo playing a mournful organ melody and murmuring, "Almighty God, enough, enough," a confession of remorse. As Aronnax reached the escape boat, shouts erupted, not about their escape, but about the Nautilus being drawn into Norway's deadly maelstrom. Their small boat was carried into the spiraling current amid roaring waters breaking against rocks. The Nautilus fought like a living thing, its steel frame cracking. "We must hold on," Ned shouted. "We may still be saved if we stick to the Nautilus." Before finishing, they were hurled into the whirlpool and Aronnax lost consciousness. He awoke in a fisherman's hut on the Lofoten Isles with Ned and Conseil safely beside him. Perhaps the ocean's greatest mystery remains not what lies in its depths, but the tortured soul who made it his home.